Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 52. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Whiplash. Whiplash is a film that actually premiered last year, early in the year, at the Sundance Film Festival, went on to win tons of awards, was released wide later last year, and then went on to get tons of notoriety, even though lots of people probably haven't seen it. But we do want to talk about it because we also love this film, and it was nominated for Best Picture this year. Also, it was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for J.K. Simmons, which we all kind of agreed was incredibly well deserved. So we hope to see how this film actually does. We want to get this podcast out there in time for the Oscars. Helping me talk about Whiplash is Josh Larson, who is from Think Christian and the Film Spotting podcast, if you're familiar with that. Also, Mark Wingerter, who's a writer, a drummer, coincidentally enough, and contributor to the show. In this episode, we're going to get to talk about the pursuit of perfection, why aim for perfection in the first place, art versus the real world, how we define success, how to not motivate your son and or student, and the two most harmful words in the English language. We have a ton to talk about and have a great time doing it. So here it is, episode 52, Whiplash and the Cost of Perfection. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. Or trying to kind of follow what you do.
Sure.
I've noticed that it seems like you have your hand in a bajillion things.
And maybe not that many, but... They're not all seemingly working in concert, maybe is what it is. So sometimes people are confused.
Yeah, well, Mark was just asking because it's not his job to be familiar with other guests' work. My job. Sure. And he was like, did Josh write two reviews? I was like, well, yeah, there's the one for his blog. There's the one for Think Christian. And did you actually write anything for Film Spotting, or did y'all podcast on it?
Yeah, we did.
You did podcast on it.
We did an episode on it, and then it's come up a number of times. Adam had it on his top 10 list, so mm-hmm. We talked about it in our year-end roundup show. We were talking about it just last night, actually, because we recorded our Oscar episode with picks for who we think will win, who should win. So it came up a number of times there. So we've talked about it a lot. There isn't really any writing that I do for Film Spottings, which mm-hmm. is kind of one of the nice things about it. I can, you know, I usually will have written about it in one form or another ahead of time, and mm-hmm. then I just get to kind of have a conversation about it. So that works out pretty well.
Well, I don't know if it's like over complimentary, but I really honestly didn't expect you to email back in a timely manner. But then not only did you email back in a timely manner, you emailed back faster than anybody. You emailed me back faster than my wife does.
Wow. Well,
I mean, like, I'm just like, hey, Josh.
Call boom. That. I don't know. You could look at that the bad way. It's the over-organized, obsessive, compulsive side of me that I tend to try to deal with things right away, and uh-huh. that helps me move on to the next thing. So, but yeah, it was Josh Crabb who initially reached out a while back, and mm-hmm. and I was familiar with him, I think, from Twitter, possibly Letterboxd, though, maybe both. Sometimes, you know, with a bunch of these networks, you get confused where you first met somebody, but
exactly.
So I was familiar with Josh and through him, you guys a little bit. So there's, you know, not enough places talking about film in this way. So I was excited to get a chance to do it.
Yeah, I think my question was more of like, if just thinking of it as a writer, like, did you write two different separate reviews? And I was kind of thinking, like, why not link, you know, one to the other to make it a little bit easier on yourself?
Yeah.
Well, you have kind of, or do you write with two different audiences in mind?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
That's pretty much it. So the website that I've had for, I don't know. I think it's been 10 years or so now.
Mm-hmm.
It was really started when I was working at the newspapers, and they were just getting into the web. And I thought, well, you know, I should be here. And I used it and still do mostly for myself. It's just a personal archive that's live. So
yeah.
When I want to reference what I've written about something, it's a really easy way to find it.
Mm-hmm.
So that audience is really, you know, a mainstream audience. Think of it the same way I did as the newspaper audience, people who are genuinely interested in movies and just want to, you know, hear a take on them. And Think Christian is, you know, a much more specific audience, culturally engaged Christians who are swimming in this sort of stuff,
yeah.
Either intentionally and thinking about it deeply and theologically, or perhaps not always intentionally and want to start doing that or are intrigued about how to do that. So obviously, you know, that's going to bring up different concerns. And so we just try to bring about some theological resonance to draw it out of the films. And the challenge is always, which is complete, to be completely honest, I'm still struggling with how to do this because it's a newer form of writing to me, is to do that without hijacking the entire picture.
Yeah.
Right. So that's, you know, that's the challenge. And sometimes films, I feel, will offer something up within themselves that make it really easy. And Whiplash was one of those with this yeah. central theme of perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a, you know, the perfect film to write about in both places. So I don't write about every film I see on Think Christian. It's much more of a pick and choose of what offers something to dig into from that faith perspective while you can still honor the art itself, is the ideal at least.
Yeah, but I was talking to a friend of mine and telling him I was, you know, talking to a guy that worked at Think Christian, and he was like, he had never heard of the website, and he was like, now is that Think Christian, like Think Christian like, or Think comma Christian?
where's the punctuation?
Very good question, and I will answer it by saying the name arrived before I did. So,
well, it's interesting because I don't often find myself reading Christian. I don't really read a lot of websites. I don't follow a lot of websites. I just kind of find myself on articles. But you know, knowing Christianity Today is more of a, you know, a bigger known mm-hmm. to me, and Christianity Today always seemed kind of like, you know, people who want to read something Christian versus something, you know, mainstream, I guess they would call it.
Mm-hmm.
But Think Christian actually seems more to me like Think comma Christian from a perspective of like, you know, these are our theological basis ideas behind this, but we're just presenting everything. You know, the idea of like, there's no such thing as secular, I think, is what I saw on,
right.
on the website.
Yeah. Yep.
So is that how you kind of see it? I was kind
yeah,
of curious.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I think that's, you know, that's where the punctuation would probably go. or we often talk about it as saying Think Christianly, which mm-hmm. isn't, you know, is a little awkward for the title of a website. But you know, and the thinking, that can be a tricky word too, because we're not trying to be prescriptive with it, as in this is the absolute and only way to think about it because you are a Christian. We very much try to have our articles be conversation starters or mm-hmm. raise
right.
the question. Now, you know, good writing comes from a firm point of view and perspective. So that's not to say that the pieces don't have opinions and aren't offering up one person's particular take on how faith applies to, say, a film or an album or, you know, whatever might be going on in the news today, whether it's vaccinations, which we've been talking about this week.
Oh, yeah.
But it is to say, you know, we are offering this up. We're not laying down the law and saying, you know, think like this, Christian.
Yeah, right.
At least, you know, again, that's what we hope to do. And
yeah.
some pieces are more successful than others. So,
well, I mean, I like that concept that you're kind of throwing out there with just kind of encouraging people to think or using articles as conversation starters. Because, like you mentioned before, there are some films like Whiplash, which are going to have a central theme that we can easily apply our worldview to and try to answer questions that the film raises. And then there's other films like Guardians of the Galaxy, mm-hmm. which, like, we obviously review on this show, and we want to talk about it from a Christian worldview, but we want to respect the art. We don't want to start being like, this is what this movie's trying to say. So instead of trying to do that, we would want to start a conversation. What kind of things does this movie have in it? What kind of situations would we come into without trying to say that the movie has an agenda for this or that? And basically right. just start the conversation from it. And yeah. some films are easier than others. But when you're going to try to analyze the movies that are shaping culture, mm-hmm. you kind of typically have to, unfortunately, go where the money is. Unless, of course, that movie is 50 Shades of Grey, and then you can just let it go right by.
Skip you're right not over
tackle them. That one, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know if there's some things that are so on the nose.
Yeah,
that I'm like, do we really need? It's why we don't typically review. What faith-based films or whatever?
Sure. Oh yeah, that's kind of a whole nother conversation. 50 Shades is interesting because I can't chide you too much for avoiding it because the Think Christian approach, and I'm really excited about it actually. We have a pastor who's written really well and thoughtfully about issues of sexuality for us before. Mm-hmm. And we've written two posts about 50 Shades of Grey from two different people.
Has anyone actually seen it though?
No, I'm talking about the book is what we've
called. Oh, the book. Oh, okay.
And those have led to some good conversations about, mm-hmm. you know, not only about sexuality itself, but how do Christians engage with a work of art that's explicitly sexual, a book. So my initial reaction, you know, I was thinking, well, we've got to do the movie, right? Because we've already written about the book.
Wives all around you are like, yeah, you really should do that movie. Yeah. So we can watch it.
Exactly. But I'm thinking, I really don't want to see that movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this pastor who's written about sexuality well for us before. I just reached out to him and he said, how about I go with my wife and we'll see it together and we'll turn in almost a transcript of sort of our conversation about it. And I was like, brilliant. I mean, not only am I really intrigued about that idea, I don't have to go see the movie. And well, turns out it's kind of a dead week next week for releases. So we're going to have to do it for Film Spotting. So after all that, I'm going to go see 50 Shades of Grey. But you know, I think I wanted to avoid it for a reason because I think it will raise some tough questions about, you know, just a Christian take on modern sexuality. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's something there. And I'm also a bit intrigued to just – I didn't read the book. So I'm intrigued to just go into it and just be like, what does what I'm seeing on the screen – say to me? I mean, I know from reading about the phenomenon so much that there are people that are going to be screaming at it from so many different angles. I listened to your mm-hmm. guys' American Sniper conversation, which I really wanted to jump in, and that was a good talk you guys had. And there's something similar where so many people have claimed mm-hmm. the movie from different vantage points, and that's happened with the 50 Shades book. So I'm eager to kind of blot all that out and look at the movie as sort of a fresh slate of what is this film saying about sexuality? How does that incorporate with, you know, how is it as a film, first of all, and then how does it connect with, if at all, a Christian understanding of sexuality, you know, as God intended for us? So I think there's some stuff there, but I did have to be forced into, a little bit forced into getting to it.
The only person you really have to convince is yourself, Josh. So if that's what you have to tell yourself.
Did you tell him struggling with that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the only other pre-show question that I was really going to ask, which I feel like I don't want you to answer now, is kind of the difference in what you saw as who would probably win the Oscars and who you think should win some of the big categories in the Oscars. But you just said you did an episode on it, so I would encourage everyone to just go listen to you do that.
Right.
I'm guessing that's what you cover, right? You kind of say, yep. Well, this is who we should think should win, but this is who we probably think will win.
If yeah, exactly. Different. And we did Best Picture, Director, the acting categories, and we had, as he does about once a month, the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips was on, which is always a lot of fun. So that is this week's show. So that should be out Friday. That's the 13th, I think, right?
That actually it is the Friday, Friday 13th.
We have two in a row. We got one next month too.
Yeah, that's there you cool. go. Well, with that said, one of the Best Picture nominees is Whiplash. One of the reasons that we're recording this episode is because it is nominated for Best Picture, and it's a dang good film.
It really is.
Usually I let people kind of answer that question on their own, but I'm going to go ahead and put it out there that I think this is a really good film. I mean, it made both mine and Mark's top 10 lists. I'm pretty sure it made yours, Josh, somewhere in the middle,
it was
right?
It was somewhere between 11 to 20, something like that. I really did like the film quite a bit and revisited it a few days ago, and as often happens, liked it even more the second time, so...
Nice. Well, I think the big thing about this, or the reason that I think it's exceptionally worthy of talking about, is because it's a movie that I don't think we'd typically see nominated for Best Picture and Oscars. I mean, because you really don't have a ton of star power. You don't have, like, a star director. I mean, like, it's not that any of these things are bad or the actors are bad, but, you know, Miles Teller, J.K. Simmons, Paul Reiser... You know, when's the last time we saw Paul Reiser in something? Yeah. Right. Or at least, you know, that most people saw Paul Reiser in something.
It was kind of a shock when he showed up, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I didn't know. And it's,
what's going on?
I mean, like, gas is, like, under $2 now. And, like, Missy Elliott's doing the Super Bowl, and Paul Reiser's in a movie.
That's right.
It's the 90s.
What happened? You know, Damien Chazelle, is that... Is that the director? Is that how you pronounce the director's name?
Yeah, Chazelle or Chazelle.
I want to say Chazelle, but that's only because I'm from the South. but, you know, he's not a household name. And so you have a movie that premiered at Sundance that's actually stuck around all year to earn an Academy Award nomination. So in and of itself, this to me is almost a phenomenon. So I'm really excited to talk about it. The general premise, hopefully most of you have seen it if you're listening to this, but if you haven't, the premise is a promising young drummer enrolls at a cutthroat music conservatory where his dreams of greatness are mentored by an instructor who will stop at nothing to realize a student's potential. We realize that nothing also involves lots of abuse and other things. So we start this the way we more or less start everything else. And Josh, you're on Skype, so you get to always answer every question first. That way we get to judge your answer and go from there. But I usually ask, like, did you enjoy the movie? But we've kind of already covered the fact that we all enjoyed the movie. So what struck you about this film? Like, when you left, like, what kind of stuck with you?
What an ending, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's... I think one of its distinct markers among the films of the year. And at first, you know, as you're talking, Mikey, about the anomaly it is as a Best Picture nominee, that's interesting because maybe it was the appearance on number of top 10 lists that got it that, because it didn't really break out at any one point throughout the year. Sundance, it was huge, and then it did have this eventual release throughout the year, but for a while people were wondering why it wasn't doing better box office, because it did have that ending that seemed like it would send people out of the theater wanting to talk about it, just trying to figure it out. I know that I was. So the movie, you know, that's what stuck with me the most, is that not only was it a thrilling extended sequence, that final concert that we get, the standoff between these two characters, but it also was this subverting, maybe not even subverting, it was just this mixing up of what we thought we had known about the film. And for me at least, completely complicating what the movie had perhaps seemed to be saying or suggesting or hinting at. It certainly broke apart from whatever conventional narrative trajectory it had been following, where we could see that this kid, you know, he was picked early, he showed talent, he hit a wall, ran into some obstacles, but now for the end, he's gonna come back and really triumph. There are elements of that, but I think if you watch closely and you think about it in context of what happened before, it really subverts itself with its ending. Maybe that's why people didn't come out of this necessarily saying, oh, it was such a great inspirational ending. It's almost structured that way, but the movie itself is eating away at that structure in those final moments. And that, you know, in addition to so many of the things we're going to get to, the performances, the editing, the use of the music itself, that ending is what kind of made me sit up and think, okay, this is a really special film.
Yeah, that ending in and of itself, when I think of a movie that I'm typically watching, the stereotypical movie that people are really enjoying, it's like, there's this character, this thing happens to him, he overcomes it, and we, as an audience, typically know what's right and wrong, so we know what should happen by the film's end. And at the film's end, we're like, whoa, what we just thought our character had learned, he basically turns his back on and uses that to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to couch this right now, too, and say that this show isn't really like a spoiler-free show and then a spoiler show. I mean, we're talking about like the narrative themes that run throughout the film. So, Josh, if you feel like spoiling anything, the audience knows. At least they do now. We're going to spoil this film. And so if there's anything that you want to talk about, don't hesitate to drop those details. But, Mark, what did you think about the ending?
Well, the ending is...
As a drummer, what did you think about the ending?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I am a drummer, but, you know, the drumming is not the centerfold here. It's the journey. And you know, the ending is a culmination of a very intense ride. I mean, this movie, the reason why I think it captures a lot of people is because it does one of the best things that films do, and that's take you on a very journey that's... It's intense, but it also feels very personal because you feel connected to these characters. And so you feel like you're going through something. And, you know, a lot of movies that come out in the summer and, you know, spend hundreds of millions of dollars to provide a thrill ride. I mean, this one was made for like $3.5 million, and it's a very small movie with not any special effects. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and took you on this just intense, just almost unbearable at times, you know.
I'm sweating.
You're just like, your heart's racing. I mean, it's like that.
Thrill is a great word for it. I mean, that's what comes to mind, too. And you're talking about a movie about drumming, right? But
it's
thrilling, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, drumming and music and everything is just kind of the setting. I mean, this is a very, like, you know, mental, grueling thing that this character goes through. And you feel it. You feel it with him. You feel this, like, insatiable desire to succeed, to get everything right, to be perfect. And part of that, and maybe most of that, is the performance of J.K. Simmons as the mentor of Fletcher. You know, he is so good at what this part is, you know, consists of, which is this guy that's going to browbeat you and manipulate you in every way that he can possibly think. Like, his whole life is a manipulation, so much so that you really don't come out of this movie knowing what kind of character he is, who he really is. And he does it so well that you feel that. You know, you get right in there with it. So the ending is just this... it's kind of an original kind of way to do it, like we've been saying. And it's just this culmination of this ride of, like, you know... Because I think the thing that's so great about the ending is that it starts off like, oh no, he failed.
He just lost.
He just got beaten
right
by Goliath. I mean, you know, David is down. But then, you know, when he walks back out on that stage and just takes over, you know, you feel what Fletcher was to him the whole movie. He kind of becomes that, like, it's kind of like he finally stands back up and won't back down. You know, and takes a stand and really succeeds. And so that's, and then just, of course, the music and the way that it builds and you know, how the film starts off with the snare. You know, that's a very rudimentary thing to practice in drumming, that, you know, speeding up of the single hits, you know, and it starts off that, and then that is incorporated into the end. Like, most films have a, you know, beginning image and an ending image, and this one did it, you know, through audio, you know, through a snare. So you really, there's a lot that just fed into this connection to this movie, and it's a very personal thrill ride for everybody, I think.
So at the end, when we're sitting on the edge of our seat, because it feels like there's so many twists, not crazy, wacky, whodunit twists, like Scooby-Doo ending twists.
Right.
Like, this is, oh, I guess this is where they reconcile. Oh, he just shamed him. Mm-hmm. Oh, he just shamed him. Yeah. Oh, he's controlling him.
Twists, right?
Yeah. And we see there's no dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, there's no dialogue. And then at the end, I felt like we were all sitting around in the living room watching this movie. And when it ended, the first question I wanted to ask, and I guess I'll kind of pose it here, even though I admit that it's probably a trick question, is kind of like, who won?
Yeah.
You know, because you have Miles Teller's character, Andrew, who you're like, he basically beat back Fletcher. Mm-hmm. So he won, right? But Fletcher, through all of this journey that he puts Andrew through, gets him to become the best that he's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
So did he win? You know, so like...
Well, I think what we have to do, and here's where the idea of perfection comes in, is ask, how are we defining winning? Whose definition? Because the film offers us a few of them, and the characters mm-hmm. stand in for them and often speak about what winning means to them. And so when we watch the outcome here, I don't think there is an answer. And that is why I really respect this film, is because it makes answering that question so difficult,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't offer – I didn't find that it offered, here's what even the film thinks is the answer. Perhaps we won't know the answer. The way I would think about it, that question, which I hadn't thought about until you just posed it, is that we wouldn't know the answer until Andrew, the Miles Teller character, is maybe 30. Maybe yeah. 40.
Mm-hmm.
And what has he done with his talents, with his relationships? That's a crucial through line to this film, is
yeah.
that one of the costs of pursuing this quote-unquote perfection is the loss of relationship. So in 15 to 20 years, where are his relationships? Mm-hmm. And maybe then we could begin to wrap our minds around this crucial moment in his life that could be seen as a victory, could be seen as a backstep towards a way of thinking about perfection and a way of living that's really unhealthy. It could be seen as the ultimate loss for this guy, and we may just not know yet at the end of this film.
Yeah, and one of the things that this film like really swings at, like a big theme that it goes for, is, you know, we're talking about this idea of perfection and winning and what that means to attain that. You're exactly right. It for him, it's and really in life, it takes a lot more than like what the way that Andrew sees this at the beginning of the film of like, I want to be one of the greats. What does that look like? I mean, if you attain this certain, you have this great performance, or you have this, you know, it's like he was when they were sitting around the dinner table and he was, you know, teasing his brothers about, you know, you'll never be in the NFL. You know, it's like achieving that one flashy goal is like, that's it. That's perfection. That's being one of the greats.
Yeah, when really, the notoriety behind it.
Yeah, and so what really this film is exploring is how big and how much that means, and it's really more about your relationships and your life in as a whole, because, you know, they talk about, Charlie, what's the drummer that I'm blanking on right now? Who becomes Bird after he gets a symbol?
Charlie Parker.
Thank you. You know, Charlie Parker had a whole career. You know, they talk about all the stuff that he's done, all the albums and all the things. You know, and you can examine a life as attaining something, attaining this perfection. And I think that's they're looking at this as like, well, he's, you know, they set this up as David versus Goliath. They set it up as like, he's got to beat Fletcher and become this awesome thing. When reality, it's saying on a broader perspective of like, your life, it has to mean something, and has to attaining that is working hard, yes, for a goal, but it's so much more than the goal.
Well, we talk about the cost of perfection,
right?
And Josh mentioned this just a second ago. Like, what does it cost him in his relationships? You know, because he's basically alienating his family. He gets up the gumption to ask a girl out,
mm-hmm.
and then basically has the most rude conversation any guy has ever had with a girl. You know, it would have been better if he would have just snuck out, like, you know, in the morning,
yeah.
than having this awkward conversation with her. He's putting his body through physical duress. And even though he has to know on some level that it's unhealthy for him to sit through, like, the emotional and verbal abuse, he keeps coming back. And not only does he keep coming back, but he comes back like with a vengeance every time. So the cost is, to me, exactly what Josh is saying. Like, when we look at this guy 15 years later, when we look at this guy 20 years later, is he going to be like the other character that's mentioned who committed suicide because he's like stressed out and has mm-hmm. all these mental issues, or was this his flash in the pan? You know, he had one great drum solo in front of some people, and maybe he becomes just another drummer in an ensemble that's fairly famous, but no one really ever knows his name.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we define perfection? And I like a lot of the stuff that, Josh, you wrote about that, and I didn't know if you wanted to expand on some of that, like, defining perfection.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, when I did think about it in terms of, you know, we do talk about perfection in terms of the arts, sports, too, mm-hmm. but in religious and faith terms, you know, in all those venues, few people would say perfection is attainable. Yeah. Okay, so it's sort of this idea that we have, yet we still strive for it in the arts, we strive for it in sports, and I think it's part of our faith to strive for it to a degree, and what, you know, Christians talk about is being perfect in Christ. And here's where the relational element of this movie is so key to me, and why that also I would say the girlfriend figure is key as well. I'm looking up her name here as we're talking, because I think she's really crucial to the film.
Nicole?
I believe it's Melissa. Yeah, Melissa Benoist.
I was going to say, I can't pronounce her last name.
Yeah, I mean, she has just a couple of scenes, but they're crucial. You know, she's the mm-hmm. opposite of Andrew in that she doesn't even have a major yet. You know, she's just she's not lazy. That's not the implication. She's just not quite as driven or obsessed. So,
yeah.
So that is a relationship that's lost. So to bring this back to the idea of being perfect in Christ, I think the only real clue we get as to what that might mean in the Bible is perfect in love, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
Because we're always going to fail. You know, sin is always going to be dogging us, and we're going to fail in those ways. But if we can strive to be perfect in love, and that is the one thing that is sacrificed, perhaps most above all by Andrew. I like that you mentioned the bodily sacrifice, because this movie is so attuned to, mm-hmm. to those physical costs too. But this relational sacrifice is key. And it's also, maybe we'll get back to it a little bit later, key to the ending, I think, in trying to break apart what's going on between Andrew and Fletcher. Because I think that what complicates it for me is that there is some sort of relational, not perfection, but almost loving recognition that happens between them that has not happened before. And so I'm sitting back trying to think about this film and what is it saying about perfection? What does it mean? And in one degree, it's almost showing me that they've come to this moment of perfect love in creating this little bit of music together that succeeds beyond anyone's expectations. Maybe not the expectations of the judges in the audience,
because
it's kind of a train wreck. But that look they share in their eyes, notice how Chazelle cuts to a close-up of each of their eyes looking at each other, and there's some, you know, loving recognition there that they've created something together. And for me, that just hugely complicates things, because no, this was not a healthy relationship.
Mm-mm.
And he's probably going to most likely, you know, go off and succumb to this sort of thinking again after having this moment. But it's, you know, it does circle back to the idea of perfection.
Yeah, and the idea of perfection is, like, you know, perfection, when you think about it, is relative. I mean, I think, it, you know, you might
for
have
sure.
mentioned, yeah, you might have mentioned that in one of your articles, or it was one of the articles that we read for this, just to kind of lead up. But, it's all kind of in the eye of the beholder. I mean, you know, because you look at the relationship between Andrew and Fletcher, and then Andrew and his father. And his father wants what's best for him, but his father's version of that is vastly different than Fletcher's version of that. And Fletcher would say that he wants the best for him. And Fletcher goes about it a certain way, and his father goes about his a certain way. And they're so vastly different, and it's kind of interesting to see how, you know, we understand perfectly how Andrew defines it, but just to kind of see how people define what Andrew's perfection is around him. Because, again, you go back to that dinner table scene, and, you know, they're like, well, yeah, he threw, you know, four touchdowns and no interceptions or whatever. You know, that's how they define perfection. You know, like, he's winning games. And what is Andrew doing? Well, Andrew's just practicing and practicing and practicing. He has no tangible results. That's how they define perfection. Andrew defines it as like being known of, you know, basically. Mm-hmm. This idea that he is one of the greats, however people define that. It's such a mind job to think about how, you know, if you want to be one of the greats, that's the cultural idea of you, and how do you even like go about defining that yourself and making that happen? It's such a, and that's the great thing about the film. It raises all these questions, and it just kind of leaves you to wrestle with them, mm-hmm. because we don't get Andrew's rest of his life. We just get one success that he has. And so, you know, the relationships in this movie are crucial, even though they're kind of on the back burner. You spend a lot of time with Andrew practicing and Andrew going through his kind of like mental torture. But the relationships are so crucial. And I think that as a Christian and from a theological perspective, you know, the only perfection that, like you're saying, the only perfection we can really achieve, if there is such a thing, is perfection and love. And that comes through relationships and community. And so when we think about perfection, it's all about the relationships. So there's so many nuances to this movie.
Well, when we talk about that, we talk about why, as Christians, are we striving for perfection? And typically, I think society would tell us that we strive for perfection for our own self-gain, especially I think in the culture mm-hmm. that we, the current culture and the current climate that we live in. Mm-hmm. And I believe that Christian culture is pretty counter to that. It's like, Josh, you're really good at doing this thing, but why? You know, what are you doing? Is it just so you can be famous? Or is it, you know, so that you can attain notoriety? Mm-hmm. Is it so that people will know your name later? No, hopefully, with our Christian perspective, it's because you're investing and you are using those gifts that you've been giving, that perfection that you've been striving towards, and you're turning in it and investing in community. You're mm-hmm. investing in God's people. You know, you're investing in culture. You're trying to make, you know, heaven on earth. You're doing your kingdom come. You're doing that kind of stuff.
Right.
And that's what's really weird to me when I think about the dynamic of his dad's pessimism versus Fletcher's, I guess, verbal abuse, striving for perfection. Because I think both of those messages are messages that we get in this culture, and neither one of them are the type of message that I would hope to convey to any artist as a Christian. Because I wouldn't want to tell any artist, well, you can't, you know, you're never going to be the next big thing. So just scale it down a bit. You know, I hear this all the time. In Greensboro, we have tons of artists. We have, you know, tons of musicians, writers, graphic artists. And all the time, these people who are striving to make a living, some amazingly talented people always ask them, well, when are you going to get a real job?
Sure.
You know, and that's Paul Reiser in this mm-hmm. movie. When are you going to get a real job? It's really, I'm really proud of you. I'm so great. Thumbs up for you drumming. But when are you getting a real job? And so the picture is the only way that you can, the opposite side of that is that you have to endure alienation. And those extremes are, I think, both dangerous. And I like the fact that this movie, even though it doesn't define what or how we attain that notoriety or how we attain success, it kind of leaves that ambiguous. It gives us two really bad examples of what not to do. Two great examples of what not to do. Two bad examples to follow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes that's the more intriguing film. You know, the one that isn't telling you what to think so much as offering up the parameters around which to think about it. And certainly Whiplash does that. It makes you think about it rather than think about what the movie says directly.
In a really brutal way.
In a really brutal way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, so there's this line in the film, and I would love you guys' opinion on this, because I don't know exactly how much the film is arguing against this outside of, because they have Fletcher say it. If Fletcher didn't say it, then I would think the film might be arguing for it a little harder. But there's definitely this sentiment in culture, and it's very conflicting. And it's when he says there are no two words more harmful in the English language than good job.
Mm-hmm. Great line.
Yeah, and I was like, man, like, I get it. Like, I can see both sides of the argument, but how do you resonate with that statement? Like, besides the fact that it's just a good line.
And I love his delivery.
And his delivery is great. Yeah. It's perfect. But, yeah. But like Josh, where do you land on that line?
So you're right. It comes from Fletcher. So we know the worldview it's coming from. He's completely upfront. Even before he has, this is the heart-to-heart after they've had their falling out and happen to run into each other at a jazz club. So previous to that, we know his worldview just by how mm-hmm. he acts, what he does, even if it's opposed to what he says when he talks quietly to Andrew. So we know where he's coming from. And now he comes out and like just says it. He has nothing left to lose. And he's not wrong.
Yeah.
He's not wrong in a sense. I don't know if I would put it in as extreme of terms as he does, that they are the worst two words. But I think it does speak to this culture of, you know, it's tied to the every kid gets a trophy for showing up mm-hmm. mentality that we have now a little bit. And, you know, I think I like, Mikey, when you're talking about, you know, how do we strive to do the best with whatever talents we've been given as Christians. You know, you hope you're going for more than good job, right? Because you do, if you have been given a gift, it doesn't honor God to ignore it or misuse it. It's praise to use it well and to honor it. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, you could say, all right, that falls in line. We don't want to be just good job. We want to, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is we do, whether it's a trade or it's an art or it's a business function, we want to do it well and honorably. So it resonates with me there. Now, the flip side is, you know how far Fletcher means to take it.
Yeah.
And he means to take it again at the cost of relationship, at the cost of all of this. And maybe that's, you know, if anything, something of a reminder we can take from the film is those of us with obsessive personalities can get caught up in pursuing things at the cost of other more important things in our lives. And it gets tricky when we feel I'm using my gift, right? I can put in 14 hours a day or whatever and ignore mm-hmm. my family or whatever it might be because I'm using my gift. So it gets really tricky there. And I think this is, you know, that one line really encapsulates the complications of the entire film because of all these nuances that it does bring up.
So this is the point in the show where I'm wondering if Whiplash and Talladega Nights are the exact same movie.
Well,
because if you're not first, you're last.
Wow.
Talladega Nights is better, I'll say that. Yeah. But
obviously a classier film, yeah. You know, more Oscar-worthy.
That is one of my favorites, and that's brilliant. I had not thought of that at all, but great. Man. I might have to write about that. Thank you very much.
that one's for free.
Yeah.
You know? I appreciate it.
I mean, but like, you know, that's exactly what I was thinking about when you're talking about, you know, how far do you take it? You have a good gift. You basically sacrifice your friendships.
Absolutely.
Because you put your gift above relationship
mm-hmm.
because it seems like the right thing to do because you've been told. Or you are in a culture that only glorifies first place. I mean, yep. I think this happens in churches a lot too. You know, like the pastor becomes the superstar mm-hmm. because unless you're up front on Sunday morning, you're not the superstar. Mm-hmm. So everyone else working behind the scenes, you know, all the assistant pastors, all the youth people, you know, the people in Sunday school services, whatever your church happens to call that, you know, the people who are setting up and taking down and running sound, those are the people who don't get to be up there. And so they kind of want some notoriety too. And you're like, one day, yeah. one day the preacher's going to say my name.
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
Well, now you're digging up, man. Now you're digging up, like, the origins of Christianity as it is today. And, you know, there's a really good book called Pagan Christianity. It's by George Barna and Frank Viola. It doesn't give any answers, but it traces the origins of very historically of the church and how it's set up now, the church service. So that's really interesting to kind of look at from a Christian perspective of, like, you know, the setup of, like, you know, this kind of fanned out auditorium facing one person, was kind of, you know, set up long ago in kind of pagan ritual and Greek philosophers and how they would speak rhetoric and that kind of thing. It was all about this one person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not to go into all that, but, you know, Constantine kind of took all that stuff and kind of put it into Christianity, and that's a very broad...
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. History lesson.
Et cetera, yeah.
This history lesson's been brought to you by not a sponsor.
That's
if
right.
You'd like to sponsor this segment.
Exactly. But yeah, so we have the, you know, even in all aspects of culture, not just Christian culture, we have this, like, is it number one and everything else, or is it number one and then good job? And I think, you know, looking at that line, the good job line, it's the connotation of good job, obviously. You know, saying a good job to somebody can be a positive thing, but it can also be a very negative thing to say, well, you know, you did your best, you know,
good job,
you know, whatever. Because it's kind of that in and of itself is this interesting kind of complexity and nuance to this relationship that they have, because saying good job in that connotation that Fletcher means it is really pushing off the relationship that you could have with somebody. You know, it's kind of saying, oh, look, you're good enough. That's good. Whatever. You're not really digging in to that person's life and helping them in any way with this connotation of saying good job. You're kind of pushing that off and saying, you know, if it were me, that'd be cool. You know, that's satisfactory. So it's interesting that because Fletcher, you know, you could argue Fletcher really does want this connection. He really wants to mm-hmm. to have this relationship that they sort of in the end kind of come to. But he wants that Charlie Parker. And at least
it's all bounded by accomplishment, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It is a relationship, and it's a creative one. But yeah, it's all based on what they'll be able to achieve. It's the achievement that matters.
So, I guess that leads me to one of my last questions. I mean, we'll still have a chance to do final thoughts and stuff if there's anything else. But I kind of wanted to end this portion of it with, was Fletcher right the entire time? Like, is the only way to achieve perfection as kind of defined by Andrew and Fletcher in this, what seems to be in this film, is the only way to do that to give yourself solely to something? Mm-hmm. You know, like, you've got to be doing it 80 hours a week or you're never going to... I mean, we watch all these movies all the time, you know, like, oh, how did they become the most famous whatever artist? How did they become, you know, the most famous person in this thing? Well, they were the best businessman because people told them they couldn't do it, and they worked harder, they sacrificed more. I mean, it's like one of the reasons that I thought Pursuit of Happiness was a terrible movie, just because it was like, look, I'm willing to sacrifice everything that means something to me so I can attain monetary wealth. Mm-hmm. And then basically ignore my son for, you know, a whole long time. So, you know, it's things like that. So is Fletcher right? If we want to attain success as they're defining it, do we have to do that?
Well, what's interesting about that is this idea of giving yourself completely over is actually tied to, from what I understand, from the little reading I've done, is when John Wesley would write about the idea of Christian perfection. Mm-hmm. It seems to be his concept was rooted in the idea of drawing a line. There is nothing else that matters but giving yourself over to God, giving everything mm-hmm. over. And that's similar language. So then I think what we ask is the to what end question. And so in the movie's terms, in Fletcher's terms, is that what it takes to give yourself completely over? Maybe, perhaps. Now, the end is something maybe that is not worth it, because it's back to this elevating of the self and through achievement, through some sort of self-glorifying act. And then we're the exact opposite of where Wesley was going. So, yeah, I mean, I think the movie definitely sets up that it took all of this sacrifice and self-giving over that Andrew did to reach that point. But there's that other tricky thing in that they didn't come out and win a jazz competition with a flawless performance. What they did was a disaster if you were in the audience, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you were sitting in the audience, you have no idea what's going on. So whatever this element of perfection they achieved was maybe only perfect for the two of them.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, was he right the whole time? I think he's right in his idea of, you know, that it takes a lot of work to be successful. You know, that's kind of the basis of where he starts, and then Fletcher takes it to this place of, well, you have to become one of the greats or else I've wasted my time. You know, it's kind of like taking a thing that should be something that, you know, like a minor indulgement and making an ultimate, and it takes away your life and it takes away your relationships and everything. So it's kind of a yes and no. I mean, he's right. You know, it's biblical, you know, unless you work, you're probably not going to eat, you know. unless you're, I don't know, lucky. But, you know, it's this idea that, you know, because being a musician, I'm looking at this partly as a musician, looking at what he did to learn these parts and to get better. I mean, if you are a drummer, there's a lot of, you know, rudiment stuff that they do in here that stuff that I practiced in marching band and have practiced, you know, in my time as a drummer. It takes a lot of work to get better. You know, you reach plateaus and you push through them and you find, you know, better technique and you study people and you listen to music. So this idea that he's got to work this hard, if his goal, and whether it's a, you know, you define it as a good goal or bad goal, if his goal is to be one of the best and one of the greats, you really, really do have to work very, very hard. I mean, blood on the drumsticks.
Yeah.
You know?
I love how the movie is attuned to the work as well. That's absolutely a great aspect of it.
Yeah, hand in the ice bucket.
That was one of my favorite shots.
Yeah.
So many cool shots in this movie.
Yeah.
Yep.
But it does really. So the idea that it takes a lot of work to succeed at something is not necessarily a bad thing. But when you make it, when it takes over your life and you allow it to become your life, I mean, that's what we're looking at as the bad thing. So Fletcher's idea that it should be your life, you should give everything to this, you know, the idea that you have to manipulate somebody and browbeat them to get them to succeed, you know, it's not necessarily a good thing. I mean, it really raises the question for me, and the thing I've been kind of chewing on as far as Fletcher goes is he a villain? I mean, does this film have a villain, and if so, is it Fletcher? Because,
or does it have two villains?
Does it have two villains, or does it have two heroes? I mean, it's a really interesting, because he's not he basically most of the movie is a traditional, intriguing villain, and a good one. But ultimately, what happens with that? I mean, does the villain get defeated? I don't think so. You know, so anyway, to answer your question, I don't really think it is a cut and dry answer to say was he right the whole time. It's very nuanced.
So I'll say this. When asking that question, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, not attributing something to the movie that it's not technically saying. And this is obviously not giving us commandments on how to live the Christian life. It has nothing to do with that. But when we start to veer off and talk about what it takes to attain perfection, what it takes to really achieve, to really be successful, to really understand, to really be good at something, I think, Mark, you know, you've hit on it. You can't just wander into that. You know, it's like watching a college football player who is athletically talented go to the NFL and realize that he has to start working. You know, that doesn't always translate. I also, like Josh, you almost uncovered what I wanted to get at. I was kind of hoping it was going to be a tougher question, but you know, talking about the Christian life, it, like, there are, I think this concept of perfection, I hear people talk all the time, well, I'll never be as smart as C.S. Lewis. I'll never be as smart as this ancient church father. How do they know all these scriptures? You know, how did Jonathan Edwards give these amazing sermons? You know, how did he just know the Old Testament forward and backwards? Well, it's because while you, random person, are devoting, you know, 4 hours a night to Call of Duty, Jonathan Edwards is spending like 10 hours a day memorizing the Old Testament, you know,
yeah.
Like,
yeah. He after a half hour of Call of Duty, he was like, I'm done. I've hit my limit for the day.
Yeah. He's like, my KDR is pretty good. I'll go hit some Old Testament now, right. You know? Cause you know, doing the, having a good kill death ratio it really prepares you to read the Old Testament, you know,
<does. laughs>
you know, it helps you in Genesis. So when people are saddened by, you know, their Christian walk, it sounds so hokey, but you know, their spiritual life, their relationship with Christ, I basically say, well, you know, Christ isn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, he's basically waiting for you to come into the practice room and, you know, be there.
Mm-hmm. It's devotion, right? Sort of devotion is what we're talking about.
So we know, what's Fletcher right? I would say, you know, if you want to be good at something, you do, you know, you do, like, what did we say earlier? You know, good, like being a good job Christian,
right,
is not good enough. And unless you're cool with being a good job Christian, which a lot of people are, then if you want to be better at it, you got to work at it. So, I would extrapolate and take away from the film, even though obviously it wasn't.
It's important to define being better at being a Christian, what that means, because, you know, this idea that someone is more holier than thou. Doesn't exist in Scripture. Scripture says, you know, it's the whole doctrine of the priesthood of all believers and all that. So what does that mean? And that's more about, you know, just kind of, it's going back to the idea of perfection that we see is relational. You know, it's a relationship that you build community. And what you're trying to say, you know, as far as being a good job Christian or being, you know, a devoted Christian, I guess, is just really just working on your relationship with God. I mean,
Self dissatisfaction.
Yeah,
it's
beneficial. It's a beneficial work. Yeah. You know, it's not achieving something.
Yeah, but, to be clear.
Yeah.
What's solo gratia? Whatever.
Right.
We're good.
Right.
no heresy, right?
Yeah. No.
I guess depending on what
where depending
what,
on how you what, find
what,
heresy
what, yeah what background you're coming from
and, that could get in some trouble
oh
there.
Christianity so anyway, like I said, we asked that question to start to wind down, and to wind down we always try to air our grievances with what we call our come on moments. Can be almost anything, at least favorite moments. So is there anything, Josh, that you just like it didn't work in this film, or you just didn't like?
Yeah. So what kept it off my top 10 list, or what keeps it from ranking as high as Talladega Nights? Maybe if Fletcher had prayed to baby Jesus, then this would have jumped right ahead.
We've already seen on what is it, Saturday Night Live, that Will Ferrell could have played the drums.
That's true. That's, yes.
Exactly.
Yes. So he could have been the drummer.
And Step Brothers is a great scene with the drums.
I didn't really have any, you know, major complaints. I guess the car crash sequence felt a little contrived to me in setting that whole confrontation up, and the, you know, the tackle on the stage just felt a little heightened, even though every scene between them in those practice rooms was so heightened and chairs had already been thrown.
Yeah.
I don't know, that still threw me off a little bit. And we referenced it a number of times because I think it is crucial in understanding some of the questions the movie wants to raise. But I do think that dinner scene with his cousins is pretty poorly handled. It's very didydactic. And as soon as those, you know, the guy walks in the room, you know you know where this scene is going and what they hope to achieve in it, and it proceeds for the next 6 minutes. So it was just – it's almost one of those when a film is so precise otherwise, and you know, I briefly referenced the editing here, how the use of insert shots. Mark, I think you mentioned that, the insert shots that are just so not only beautifully timed but spot on and perfect and give us this tactile feel for what it takes to create music at this level. Mm-hmm. When you have that sort of precision going on and then you get a clunker scene like the dinner table, it stands out all the more. But really, those are, you know, those are just minor quibbles.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I was going to ask when you brought that up, because it sounded like, I was like, if those scenes were in other movies, I don't think I would have had that big of a problem with them.
Yeah.
But it was, those were two of the places in the movie where I wasn't really on the edge of my seat.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was
a little rushed,
it was talking about intense things. I don't really feel like it was, as you know, obviously I wasn't like, what's he going to yell at him next? You know, I was.
Yeah.
So, I'm with you there, but Mark, what didn't sit right with you?
Yeah, definitely agree that the car crash felt a little contrived. Mm-hmm. It ended up working well, and made just, you know, the whole thing a lot more intense than it already was. But it felt a little, I was getting to that point and I was like, really? just a little bit. But, you know, as I go back and think about the film more and after seeing it a second time, I realized that I never really bought that Andrew really wanted to be one of the greats. He just kind of, like, that was his character. Like, that's where he was written. And he just was kind of set up because, you know, he listened, he knew a lot about music. He listened to, you know, Buddy Rich albums and stuff like that. But it was all just kind of like, he just kept saying that he wanted to. And I never really felt that he was like, I will give up everything to be one of the greats. I saw it in his work when he was just, you know, furiously hitting those drums and punching through the snare head and bleeding over everything.
But, bleeding on everything.
Right. But it always felt to me, in terms of the journey of the film, that he wanted to just beat Fletcher or wanted to just achieve something now. And I never really bought that, I guess, that he wanted to truly be one of the greats or maybe even understood kind of what that meant. And so that's part of the journey, but also, you know, he just kind of was saying these things. Mm-hmm. It was almost like in the performance, I never got that feeling. I was like, oh, you know, you know, but
I think this, it would help if probably, I can see what you're saying because it's, in some sense, it's a tamped down performance a little bit. And it's certainly different than what Teller gave in The Spectacular Now, which was just flying on this, you know, wonderful charisma. Mm-hmm. And here he's kind of quieter and concentrated because, you know, he's focused on the work. But the one scene that did convince me of it, though, is the premature breakup that he does, where it's essentially he's willing to cut this off. You know, most people would just let it die out, right? And become a really bad boyfriend, just ignore her except for when, you know, it's convenient for him. But he seems so obsessed with becoming great that he doesn't even want to let that get in the way. He's like, we're going to be done now because I know pretty soon I'm not going to have time for you. I mean, the level of cruelty in that scene kind of clued me into how obsessed he was.
Yeah, I agree with that. There was a little bit of just to end my come on moments, a little bit of drumming, you know, edits that were missed. And I was like, that, he didn't just play that. I had a little bit of that. I was like,
Yeah, so that's the kind, when I see a film like this, I'm almost glad I don't have any level of expertise because I know I would probably catch those and it would take me out of the movie. And
I was definitely, I caught a couple and I was like, I missed that one.
Well, I mean, you had a very long scene to find anything in that long drumming scene at the end. I mean,
actually, believe it or not, the end, he nailed most of that.
Really?
And I'm pretty sure he nailed all of it because when he was approached to play this part, you know, they said that he was a drummer in real life.
Well, I mean, I've read that he's a drummer. Asked him personally,
but the director brought him this solo that he wanted him to play, and he was like, I'm sorry, what? You want me to do that? And he's like, it's gonna be like CGI, right? You know, I'm not actually gonna do that. And so I think that climactic scene, he probably nailed. Like, now, he probably knew it.
Does this mean you knew right away whether he was rushing or dragging, or did it take you a while?
Actually, yeah, I did know if he was rushing and tracking. Well, some of the edits right there in that scene weren't exactly on, so it was kind of hard to tell. But okay. there were a few places during that scene where it was like, yeah, well, you're rushing.
Yeah. So. Well, okay, so.
I'm not this crazy musician or anything.
So I'll say this. So we end, hopefully, praising a film that we all enjoyed. So, Josh, what were your favorite moment or two from this film?
I think every confrontation scene between Andrew and Fletcher, which is, you know, saying what, 70% of the movie, but they are they're the bedrocks, right? And we get these. There are three that stand out. The first one when he's introduced to join Fletcher's group, and then the tryout sequence you were just talking about, I think, where the three of them are rotating, and then that final fantastic sequence. I mean, the thing about Simmons, just to say really quickly, is that this is such a big role in terms of loudness, volume. Yeah. And that could easily have gone so wrong. I mean, the scenery is pre-salted for this guy, is the way I described it. Mm-hmm. It's just waiting for him to come in and chomp away. But I think he holds just enough back where he's never outside of the character and he's never outside of the point of the scene. So the scene doesn't become about his performance ever. It always becomes about what is this saying about the relationship between the two and the journey for them. So... So Simmons is really, you know, I do hope he gets the Oscar because it's quite a performance.
Yeah, I mean, like I want to say, not to sidetrack with the Oscars. Like, I really dug, you know, Edward Norton in Birdman, but man,
I
mean, it's just because J.K. Simmons. It wasn't just that he was yelling at him. It's occasionally that he would obviously be perturbed and be holding it back, and he would just add these. Out with these little words, just like, that's okay, not my tempo, but, you know, like, and he would do it just slightly different every time. And it gave you the feel that this man wasn't just, like, taking a crap on these students.
Yeah.
Like, he actually had a tempo, and they were not doing it.
Absolutely.
You know? Like, I never doubted it for a second.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, Mark, what made it for you?
Well, I mean, you know, keep on J.K. Simmons. I mean, the best acting that he does is really not in the yelling and the browbeating. I mean, he does that so well. You know, with that quick cut off. Yeah, that quick cut off.
Oh God, that hand motion.
He does that so well, but there's so many moments where he's so subtle. Like when, you know, what we learn as, you know, as he Andrew stumbles upon him at the jazz club, and that whole conversation. Especially when you see it a second time and you know that he's manipulating him the entire conversation.
Yep.
And that, he knows that this is not his character. This is a manipulation. And he plays it so subtle and so well that you just buy the manipulation. You get manipulated by this guy. So that was just... I love brilliant performances, and it's one of the best. Like, it's a shame that he's actually in the supporting actor category. I guess they thought it was easier for him to win the supporting actor, and so that's the way that they, you know, kind of nominated him. But I think he was better than Michael Keaton in Birdman. I mean, I think he's the best... to me, he was the best performance I've seen all year. But anyway. I'm unashamedly a fan of pretty brutal, debased humor. So... these lines that he was throwing out, he has so many great one-liners that you can't repeat on this podcast. So
you can't repeat those many places.
Many places, yeah. Maybe with a group of guys or something.
Yeah, only in your accountability groups.
Yes, exactly. but you know, just this film and the ride that it takes you on is one that I just thoroughly enjoyed, and that climactic final scene is. I mean, it's just special. I mean, it's just amazing, you know, and what they kind of come to and achieve. It's just such a great, great moment. And how do you choose any other moment than that?
Well, I was going to say, so the climax to me, that drum off, the stare down, the pulling back and forth of power, oh my gosh, I remember, like I said, I remember us sitting in our living room. We're all watching this movie for the first time. Me and Mark, a couple friends. And, like, I am literally on the edge of my seat.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm perspiring a little bit. Like, I like the movie has had so many like just little twists that I don't know what's gonna happen. I'm like, is he gonna mess it up? Is he gonna succeed? Is J.K. Simmons' head gonna explode? Is this a scene from Scanners? Like, I don't know what's going on, you know. And it was just so intense. And like, I remember, like, you know, when it cuts out, like, we're all just sitting there with our mouths hanging open and our eyes are huge, just looking at each other, being like, "Did that just happen?" Yeah. Like, I just, there are very few films that did that for me, especially this year. Mm-hmm. The rushing or dragging scene, you know, not a very uplifting scene, obviously, but when that scene was happening, like, I had an out-of-body experience, like, looking at myself, like, again, wide-eyed, mouth gaping open, being like, am I watching this happen?
Yeah, it's intense.
I was like, I just don't see things like this. And, you know, because it's not that it was like, oh, he asked him like three times and it was over. Mm-hmm. It just kept going on.
Yeah.
And that told you so much about everything that was going to happen in the movie. Everything was happening right there between those two characters. Told you so much about Fletcher. I'm really, really impressed by like little scenes like that.
Yeah, and another one, like all of the slight manipulations he does are really well crafted. Like, you know, the one where somebody's out of tune and he just berates that kid. And you're like, dude, he was out of tune. He gets out of there. He's like, yeah, it wasn't him. It was you. But if he didn't know, that's worse.
Yeah.
Yep. You know? So many scenes have that little twist to them, don't they?
Yeah, it's such a great line, you know, which is worse. Gosh.
And I did really, one of my favorite things, I did really want to point out the shots, some of the cool shots, like when Fletcher traces his finger over the music and the focus follows his finger. Mm-hmm. And then the blood and the ice. And it turns red, and mm-hmm. you know, stuff like that. Little nuances make this movie just really cool.
Yeah, it's really elegant.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this. So before we close out, Josh, is there anything that you wanted to throw in there? Final thoughts, things that you just wanted to mention about the film?
I think we covered it. I was afraid we weren't going to get to. Get to J.K. Simmons, but yeah, we definitely gave him his due, and I mentioned Teller's performance. I think mm-hmm. Teller's a real talent to watch, and you know, like I said, Spectacular Now was so different, equally as good, if not a little better, but I also like that this early in his career he's able or willing to play someone so unlikable, because I don't think this is necessarily you know, a character that you come to like much more by the end of the film than you did at the beginning, and that's not the usual pattern for these sort of movies. For him as an actor to pull it off and be willing to do it, you know, just hints that he's going to be worth watching closely in the future.
Yep.
All right, Mark.
We didn't get to. I wanted to kind of talk about mentors and proteges because you had done that with the film spotting guys, I think.
And, yeah, we did our top five top relationships, mentor protege relationships. That's right.
Yeah, I just think that fight is an interesting conversation, but we do not have time for that for sure.
Whole other show.
Yeah,
I don't need to. Film spotting's done it.
That's right.
Yes. It's like the Simpsons did it thing.
Yeah,
film spotting did it. You know, do you want to have a top five? Film spotting did it,
yeah,
and rightly so.
That's great. Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's a cool. It's not something you usually think of, because it took me a while to think of something that I was going to point out Patches O'Houlihan in Dodgeball.
I like how in this like Oscar nominated film we keep like referencing like these
Will Ferrell movies,
yeah, we're Ben Stiller movies. It, huh?
Oh man, well. Speaking of film spotting, Josh, I really appreciate you taking the time to be here, and I wanted to make sure that you had a chance to let people know how they can follow your work in a bajillion places.
Yeah, and, it's almost a bajillion. I'm trying to keep it under that, but film spotting, you know, we're on iTunes, so a lot of people find us there. The website's filmspotting.net, weekly podcasts that would be fantastic if you checked it out. Otherwise, you can find me the best, you know, the handle I use most places is Larson on Film. So that's my website. I'm pretty active on Letterboxd and Twitter, Facebook, and thinkchristian.net if you're interested in having conversations like the one we just had, more tied to theology and film. We do that there.
Nice. Indeed. Mark, how can people follow you?
Basically, come find me on the social sphere. You can get me on Twitter. It's at Mark Wingdinger. It's just a weird version of my last name. And then I'm a writer, a screenwriter, and I'm working pretty hard on a script right now. So I'm doing a lot of behind the scenes stuff. But I do post on Real World, and just talk to me online.
Cool. And as for me, you can follow me on Twitter at Physification. You can follow the show at Real World Theo. If you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, then if you already haven't, visit our website at realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com, because we're super clever. Connect with us on Facebook or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you enjoy it, review the show, leave us some feedback, tell your friends, tell your grandma, tell your mama, tell your daddy. Let's get more people involved in the conversation. Heck, check out Think Christian. It's a great resource that we use. So again, thanks so much, Josh, for being here. Thanks so much, Mark, for being here.
Thank you. It was a really good conversation. Glad we could do it.
Every time I have new guests on, it's always so much fun just to make that new connection, and or have Mark on, whatever.
For sure.
I'm staying ahead of the how many podcasts people have done. I think I'm still in the lead, maintaining my lead.
I thought Laura passed you. She might
maybe.
Have. She
well,
has
I
my
think
wife.
You have Holology. She's your wife.
Well, who watches it? Anyway. Whatever, we're going to talk about this later. Okay. Anyway, so thanks also to you, the listeners, for taking time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, just remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com. I think if you make good art, people don't care that you're Christian. They just care that you made good art.
Yeah.
And, if you're a great film critic, people are like, oh, he's a Christian? Oh, that's weird.
You know what? That's funny you say it. That's probably the response that I do get is, oh, okay, that's weird. But it's not a deal breaker,
Yeah, because you're a good critic.